19. A dog barked inside one of the trailers, barked, then growled. Then a squat white lady in sweats came out, her hair in curlers, talking on her phone. She saw me, squinted in confusion a minute, then went back inside. The screen door slammed behind her. I tried to imagine Mr. Maris inside one of those tin cans, sitting motionless in the darkness, watching me through slatted blinds with his bright golden eyes. I imagined Jackdaw under a bed. I pictured him in the narrow space between a refrigerator and a wall. I would have to go from house to house, trailer to trailer, knocking on doors or climbing in windows. It was getting along toward twilight, and I squinted in the growing darkness at the bank of parked vehicles. The sky was dense, low, heavy with rain that wasn't yet ready to come down. Not right. Something wasn't right. I turned and walked back up the lane.
You need something?
Let me guess, I said, raising a hand to the man now standing at the door of the market. You're Slim. He didn't answer. He watched me as I walked over. Slim had a long, droopy brown mustache, and his eyes were droopy too, coming down at the corners like he was born sleeping and never quite woke up. Slim bent his head slightly and spat. My shoe heels crunched on the gravel.
I asked what you needed, boy.
I flinched and hid my flinching. I felt my mouth turning up into a scowl, and I ordered it not to do that. The little one-syllable insult, boy, it worked as it always did. Like a little chunk of gravel, a pointy rock of disgust and contempt. I smiled. God forgive me, I did. The word hit the side of my face, and I smiled. I was working. Not meaning to bother you, sir, I said. I'm just looking for a friend of mine.
I ain't seen him, said Slim immediately.
Before I could answer, there was a short, blaring shriek, like two pieces of sheet metal scraping together from inside the body shop behind me. Slim didn't turn his head, so I didn't either. Due respect, sir, I said, nice and calm. But how do you know you haven't seen him? Can I tell you what he looks like?
Due respect, he said. Does he look like you?
I required of my smile that it widen, that it broaden and harden and glaze, become a smile that was like a shield. The answer to the question was no, of course. Mr. Maris wasn't even close to looking like me. Maris was built like a boxer, and he had metallic skin and distinctly African features. A long nose and wide nostrils, bright golden eyes. He didn't look shit like me. If you're asking is he black, then yes, he's black.
Like I said, I ain't seen him.
You mind if I come in the store a minute, have a look around?
We're closed.
My smile was having trouble. I could feel it flickering. It'll just take a second, I said. I'd just like to have a quick look. This friend of mine, see, I'm trying to find him. He said he was coming down here.
Did you not hear the man?
I turned around and saw a dump truck in mechanic's overalls.
He said, get.
The man coming out of the garage to join us was burly and bearded with streaks and smears of oil on his chest and fat stomach. Slim sniffed and spat again while the big fella snorted. They could have been a goddamn vaudeville team, these two, except that the big one was holding not a microphone but a long rifle. He had it clutched across his chest, Minuteman style. My smile gave up. It extinguished. Fuck it. I don't know what I've done to upset you fellas, I said. But I don't want any trouble.
He don't want any trouble,
said the mechanic over my shoulder to Slim, who harumphed and stroked his mustache. I turned at the sound of gravel as Fat Boy took a step forward and brandished the rifle. I steeled my jaw. Jim Dirksen wasn't going to cut it. And I found inside myself a hard man. A stone-cold anti-hero from one of those 1970s black revenge pictures from Jim Blackman's Slaveland Vengeance or one of its many sequels.
Drop the weapon, shitheel,
I said. My voice was down half an octave. I was cold and keen-eyed and hard in my shell.
Or what?
Or I'll wrap it around your fat white neck. This was dialogue. I was doing lines, but goddamn if I didn't mean it. This bearded sack of crap dropped into some kind of firing range stance, but man, I was just one step too close, and he didn't know what I was, and I had gravel in my hand, and I was flinging it in his piggy eyes, and then I was leaping at him. One big panther leap. I had him by the hair and the gun on the ground, and I slapped him with my big open hand once, twice, then three times, slapped his face back and forth like a cruel father hitting his boy because he hates himself. The mechanic was down on the ground, his hands feebly defending himself against my superior strength, the rifle at his feet in the gravel. I heard movement on the porch, and without turning, still holding Fat Boy, I said,
Stay where you are, Slim.
Hey, said the mechanic, and I kicked him in the face and his mouth blew open with blood and he turned and started to curl away.
I grabbed the gun and wheeled around and was glad to see Slim rooted to his place as instructed. A drool of tobacco spit ran from the corner of his mouth. I came at him now with the rifle, one step, two steps.
You seen my friend?
I seen no black man.
I fired. The glass behind Slim shattered and the whole door jumped and shuddered in the jam. Slim's old coyote face convulsed with fear. It felt good. It all felt good. I took another step forward and raised the muzzle to his eyes. You seen him?
No.
He kept his hands where I could see them, raised them slowly, and laced his fingers behind his head like a man who'd been trained. The interrogation was over. I believed him. He hadn't seen Maris or anybody else, but I don't know, I wasn't done.
You military, Slim?
What?
Were you in the army?
Yes.
You see action?
Yes, in the Gulf. In Texas.
Oh, yeah?
What side? He stopped talking. He stared at me.
America. Our side.
So what were you fighting for?
His eyes went down to the gun, then back to my face. My face was set and cruel.
He knew where I was going. So did I.
I couldn't stop.
I said, what were you fighting for, Slim?
For America. For the Union.
Yeah. But Texas didn't want none of the Union, right? They didn't want nothing to do with it. With us. With slavery. They just wanted to be done with it, remember?
He tried to move his head, but I had the gun pressed between his eyes, really grinding in hard between his eyes.
But you went and fought to keep the Union together.
I got drafted.
Could have run. Plenty ran. They still up there.
I was fighting for my country.
Bullshit.
All right.
He closed his eyes. He thought I was going to kill him right there. I was glad. I was tight with rage. My rib cage was a fist clenched around my heart. The sun had gone down. There were no lights in the parking lot. The moon was coming up pale and disinterested.
What were you fighting for, Slim?
He looked down. Mustache drooping down, he whispered.
Slavery.
I shot him in the knee. While he wailed, while the fat one moaned, I wiped my prints off the rifle with the sleeve of my shirt and threw it in the dirt and drove away. Chapter 16. I drove away trembling. What the hell was I doing? What did I care? Texas was the Lone Star Miracle, the success story of early 20th century activist abolitionism. In an orchestrated campaign, migrant manumissionists from all over the country flooded in, along with tens of thousands of Catholic abolitionist Mexicans drawn by the come-one, come-all immigration policy short-sightedly enacted by a state eager for oil field hands. Hence the miracle. El Milagro. The largest state in the Union, free by statute in 1939. It wasn't until 25 years later, under the first Mexican-American governor in that or any other state, that they went further, declared their intention to secede, and Washington said, the fuck you will. There was a Texan in the White House by then, one who'd been a school teacher who had some of these Mexican sumbitches in his classroom. He took it personally. These folks needs to read their history books, said President Johnson. Secession is illegal under the Constitution, and by the way, that's American oil under all that sand. 11 years of fighting. Battleships in the Gulf of Mexico, swift boats on the Rio Grande. Mexican partisans fighting hicks like Slim on the shores of Corpus Christi. Not my war. A useless, nasty war and nothing to do with me. 11 years of grueling, bitter combat ending in nothing. Uneasy detente. Contested status. They call themselves the Republic of Texas. But we keep their star on our flag. We created the Special Economic Zone to protect our oil interests in the Gulf of Mexico, and they formed the Gulf Irregulars to protect theirs. Status quo antebellum. I was shaking. My arms were shaking. I drove back slowly to the hotel, my hands at 10 and 2, not even putting in a tape.
Eyes on the road, deep breaths, hoping and praying for no checkpoints. I didn't know what I would do. Putting a bullet in a man's leg, leaving carnage behind me. In the hotel parking lot, I sat in the car a minute or more, hands on my knees, trying to get my head right. Work your case, I said to myself. Solve your goddamn case.
Someone was on the phone in the horseshoe driveway of the Capital City crossroads. There was a copse of tall hedges to the right side of the door, out of range of the streetlights, and someone was hidden by one of them, talking loudly and with emotion into a cellular phone. I could hear this private conversation as I came across the parking lot, and my instinct was to veer to the right, keep my head down, get to my room as soon as I could. It was 9:20. I had half an hour until Bridge called, and I wanted that time. I needed it. I needed to sit in the room with my hands on the desk until my body quit the shivering it had started up with. The tension of the confrontation at Slim's, the buck and kick of the firearm. I wanted time for all of it to sluice out of me and leave me empty.
No, but that's just not, said the voice.
It was Martha, my white friend from the breakfast area, from the pool.
That makes it very difficult for me to... No, wait. No, wait.
I'd walked past her. She had not seen me. I stopped at the threshold of the building, and the automatic door sensed my approach and whooshed open.
Fuck!
Martha shouted. She had not seen me.
God fucking damn it!
I stepped back, let the door whoosh closed again. No, fuck this. Come on. I stepped forward, and the door whooshed open, then back again. Whoosh. You okay? I said, and she smiled, stepping out from behind the hedges.
Well, that's... Good question.
She stuffed the phone in her pocket. She was wearing the same jean jacket, the same jeans. She did not look as if she had slept. She twisted a small mouth into a wry grimace.
Are you okay? That's the million-dollar question, right? My mother always told me to watch out.
For that question, I mean, because, like, are you or aren't you, right? It's not usually one or the other, you know? Oh, I said. Sure, that makes sense.
But no, not really.
She tugged the phone out again and looked at it, and I studied the side of her face. I've been thinking of her as a girl, a sassy kid who'd become a mother much too early. Now, sighing, frustrated, anxious in the moonlight outside the hotel, she looked like what she probably was. A woman in the first years of her 30s with a few worry lines at the corner of her mouth, with some of life's grief already in her eyes.
Everything all right with your boy? Lionel, remember? Like the train?
I remembered. I remember everything.
Oh, yes, of course. Lionel.
A long rolling shudder passed through me, and I held myself still till it was gone. I'd put a bullet in that man without thinking, without hesitation or regret. What were you fighting for? What was I doing?
The kid is fine, she gestured inside. Sleeping like the proverbial... whatever. Do you have kids, Jim?
Nope, I said. Nope. I never went down that route somehow. Never went down that road.
Right. I asked you that. You're traveling.
Yes, I said. Well, that's just it. The door whooshed and a couple came out. A man and a woman, arm in arm, whispering together. The man lifted his keys and we heard the bloop bloop of a car door unlocking somewhere out in the darkness of the lot. When I looked back at Martha, her head was tilted back and she was studying the stars.
I'm just trying hard, you know? Real hard.
I'm sure you are.
Trying so hard.
I saw myself again an hour earlier at Slim's, wielding that rifle like a lightning bolt. That was a different person who had done all that. Now this, here, this was Jim Dirksen speaking softly to a distressed stranger in the parking lot of a hotel. Jim, kind and calm, lending a comforting presence, and me underneath, searching, hunting, pushing, doing my thing.
I think you said, I began, and when she jumped, I said, sorry, sorry, but I think you said you were from here originally, like you grew up here. I'm from Indiana, not Indy. My sister lives up here, though. Sometimes we come and visit.
But not this time.
No, this time it's...
She held up the phone.
Business.
All right, well, I have a question for you. It's just a number. 1819, I said. A year, I'm guessing. Does the year 1819 have any kind of special meaning around here? Martha's expression changed sharply, completely. She dropped her eyes down to the gravel of the lot, then she looked back up, unsmiling, and spoke in a sad hush.
Where did you see that number?
Oh, I said, you know. It wasn't right, dragging my problems in front of this innocent bystander who clearly had problems of her own. I was pretty sure I already knew the goddamn answer anyway. Just something I spotted hung up outside somebody's house.
Hung up how?
On a flag. A number of them, actually, like pennants, but you know what, it doesn't matter, it's fine.
It's not fine.
Something like anger was choking Martha's face.
Because it just gets into everything.
What does?
It. All this shit.
What shit? Martha shook her head.
Where did you see them? Downtown? South side?
East side. All the questions were making me a little uneasy. I felt the need to reinforce my ID, duck under my cover for a moment. I was at a potential retail location, kind of poking around the area.
Oh, all right, she said. I see. You know what?
I said, regretting the whole line. It was 9:30. Bridge would be calling in 20 minutes. Don't worry about it, the business with the number. I'm sorry to have bothered you.
No,
she said.
No, you're fine.
She gave her head a little shake. Took a deep breath, preparing to bear up to unpleasantness.
It's the year before... What's his name?
She squeezed shut her eyes, remembering hard, then popped them back open.
LaSalle. The Indiana Supreme Court, 1820?
She closed her eyes again. She looked older with her eyes closed.
The framers of our Constitution intended a total and entire prohibition of slavery in this state. So 1820 is the year Indiana was officially and fully free.
I smiled sadly. Gotcha.
So 1819 for these dickwads? That's the good old days, see?
I see. She looked at me head on, tears standing in her eyes. The people with the flags were reversionists. People who, as a matter of politics or personal taste, regretted that their state had ever adopted its constitution and thereby abolished the practice of slavery. And it made Slim's trailer court, Slim's market, and Slim's garage the unlikeliest possible place for Mr. Maris to have landed, the unlikeliest possible place for Jackdaw the Runner to be squirreled away.
Mr. Dirksen, I'm sorry you had to see that.
Call me Jim, and it's okay.
It's not. My state is a really nice state, for the most part. It really, really is.
Oh, I get that. That's the feeling I get for sure. Mr. Bridge would be calling in 15 minutes. But here was young, kind Martha in her cheap denim jacket and her long brown ponytail tied back with a pink rubber band standing out here in the parking lot, suffering whatever it was she was suffering. She reached up to neaten the ponytail, and the motion caused the top of her white dress shirt to open slightly. And I saw, just below the root of her neck, a black box, inked in all the way. Not a lot of white people got them, but some did. A mark of solidarity or empathy or guilt. Martha saw me looking, blushed, and brought her shirt collar together.
God, she said. People think it's far away, but it's not. It's here. It's everywhere. Clouding over everything, hanging over everything. Don't you just feel that way sometimes?
I do, I said. I guess I do. With an effort of will, she made herself smile, made her eyes get hopeful.
But you know what? Maybe this thing with Batlish, you know, the president sticking up for her and all, maybe it's the beginning of some real change.
I smiled. I nodded. I'd read the same article. It had been in my own newspaper. Sure, I said, thinking, shit does not change. Thinking, it will never change. You never know.
Listen, Jim,
she said.
Hey, would you ever...
She paused. She looked down at her phone, considering something, gathering some kind of quick courage. My heart was a tight, high knot. There was some keening emotion making itself felt that I had never felt before while I stood in the invisible light of those words hanging and spinning between us. Would you ever? Then her phone rang. She opened it, and it rang again, and then we both realized together it wasn't her phone ringing. It was mine. I looked at the incoming number and at the time. It was 9:36.
Mr. Dirksen?
My phone rang again. Bridge was calling, 14 minutes ahead of schedule. I should get this.
Oh, sure.
I need to get this. The world was a confused clamor, Bridge ringing in my hand, those 1819 flags flapping in my brain, Jackdaw trembling inside a box, the rifle bucking against my shoulder, and Martha, would you ever, would I ever what?
It's...
She gave a little toss of her head.
It's nothing. Seriously. Take your call.
I answered as I turned away, and the doors whooshed open, and Bridge said,
Victor?
Short and sharp. His voice charged with some energy I did not immediately recognize. Oh, yes, hello, I said, still in Dirksen's voice, walking fast, not liking to talk to him out in the bright no-man's land of the hotel lobby. It was like I had conjured a demon to rise up out of the patterned carpet right where everyone could see it. Hey, could you hang on just a sec? I kept the phone pressed against my chest until I was back in the room, out on the balcony, with the cigarette clenched in my teeth. Would you ever... what? Would I ever...
Victor? You caught me in the middle of something. And is that a problem for some reason?
A current running through his voice like rogue electricity.
I will call when I call, Victor. Do you understand? I will call when I want to.
I took the phone away from my ear and studied it. Maybe it had connected me by accident to the wrong man, some other Victor somewhere else.
How's your progress?
I skipped the jokes. I gave the man a whirlwind tour of the day's adventures. I gave him Officer Cook and Maris on the steps. I gave him the pin I had put on Maris. I gave him the name of the doctor. I gave him the printout from Whole Wide World Logistics with the route of escape. I told him about Slims, but not about shooting Slim. The whole time I was providing this debrief, I was measuring the short, cool silences that breathed between my sentences. Something was off. Something was way off. Some new weather, a heaviness in the atmosphere, was brooding over our call like a storm system darkening the color of the sky. Like a good employee, I wrapped up my report with next steps. Tomorrow morning I would feel out the doctor, try again to pick up Maris's trail, seek out Cook the cop if I had to, prevail upon him to make another run at the recalcitrant priest. Another half step of menacing silence from Mr. Bridge. Then he said something that blew a hole in my understanding of the world like a cannonball smashing through the high wood sides of a ship.
You holding out on me, boy?
Am I... what? But it wasn't even the question.
That word again, that word.
I sucked in poison from the cigarette and felt my cheeks tremble, felt my neck get hot.
If you are dragging your feet, I will know it.
I'm not.
What I'm hearing from you, Victor, is a list of half-completed tasks, bullshit leads. This is day 3 on this.
3 days is nothing, I said. Remember Milwaukee? Fuck, man, remember Carlisle?
If you can't get this over with...
If I what?
If you can't find the man...
I was staring at the phone again, holding it at arm's length and shaking my head. We were upside down. We were in a shadow land. Bridges' aggression was way, way out of character. He was my handler, and he was handling me poorly. I noticed his uncharacteristic inarticulateness. That strange doubling back, how he had arrived at, if you can't find the man, only after, if you can't get this over with. Which was a whole different character.
If you're slow playing this, Victor, I will know that. Do you understand?
Yes, I said. I do.
You understand what that means?
I stood in silence, simmering in the implication of the question. The violence gleaming cold behind it. Looking back, I don't know why I was surprised. All that had happened was that the truth of Bridge, of me and him, had unexpectedly shown itself right up close where I could see it. It had always been violence. For 6 years it had been violence. Behind our professional exchanges and collegial banter, there had always been violence. For 6 years I'd spoken to him on secure lines, from comfortable hotel rooms, smoking my cigarettes, breathing night air, playing at freedom. But the first time I spoke to him, I was shackled in a Chicago basement. Hands tied to a table and feet to a chair, and he was a cold, unfamiliar voice spooling out from a speakerphone like a length of wire. The voice of my doom until he offered me a choice that was no choice. After all those years in the shadows, I had gotten it together. Gotten papers, gotten myself a job, loading and unloading trucks at town stores just north of Chicago city limits. 2 years. Two normal, happy, human years. Then one night I came off shift at dawn and it was behind me. A silver car was idling on Monroe Street with no plates. And I didn't even fucking think about it. I dropped the hot dog I was eating and ran, looking with wild instinct for the North Star and finding only the egg-yellow glow of street lamps. I made it maybe 30 feet before they tackled me and brought me down. While they dragged me to the car, thrashing and wailing, I thought crazily that I should have turned right instead of left. Should have gone up the alley instead of down the sidewalk. as if it mattered, as if there were any direction I could run to escape the unforgetting world. Next thing I knew, I was in a basement, federal building downtown Chicago. I was still in my work shirt, still in my nice, clean Adidas, in my blue jeans. All that peace and safety draining away, all my new life sloughing off onto the concrete floor. I was already feeling the cold steel of the chains drawing down between my shoulder blades, running in lengths around my ankles. Somebody came in and put a phone down on the table, and I stared at it, confused, until it beeped two times and a voice came on the line.
"My name is Bridge," said the voice. "I am a deputy marshal in the United States Marshal Service. I trust you appreciate the gravity of your situation. Your instructions now are simply to listen to my proposal and answer when I'm done. Your answer will be either yes or no."
Listening to his cold voice, I was thinking about cows' heads, cows' necks, bloodied flanks. Thinking of the hours and the days. Bridge said again, yes or no. And I would have done anything, yes, anything. I would have said anything, anything, forever, anything. When he was done talking, I said yes. Right away, I said yes. Of course I did. I said yes. And now Bridge, his same voice after all these years. "You understand what that means?" "It means I was there in Indianapolis in that northern hotel room, but a trap could open in the floor and crash me down into that federal building basement. The walls could fall away and show how all along I'd been at Bell's, in the stink and blood haze and weariness of Bell's farm." "You understand what that means," he said, and I did. Violence had always been behind our conversations. What's behind everything, what's under everything, violence. "Sir," I said, very slowly, very calm, "I am pursuing the case to the best of my ability." Bridge didn't answer. No more silences, brooding or angry or anything. He just hung up. Maybe there was something going on with the man I didn't know about. Maybe it was another case, maybe it was Batlish, the hearings, adding some tension to the air of those government hallways. But I didn't think so. Something was going on with this, with Bridge, with me, with this case. I was going to have to sleep, but I didn't even try it yet. I stood out on the balcony for a long time, for what might have been hours. All of it cycling through, rutting me up, Cook in the car, a special kind of kid. And Bridge on the phone, "Get this over with," and Martha Flowers, "Would you ever," all of it, all of this life. Something was piercing through me, some kind of heat burning the raw layer under the skin. Something I couldn't then explain, and that even now I have trouble transforming from thought into words, but something was happening, a dial was turning. You can imagine a compass needle twitching to life. The smallest pulse, the barest movement. Struggling for north. Twice a year, a group was graduated off the pile and moved inside. And soon enough, it was my turn. It was something of an occasion. Work halted inside and outside. Everybody circled around the flagpoles. The only kind of time like it was church, or when one of us died, or when someone was sold. Mr. Bell came out and walked down the line of us. I think it was 9 other boys and 3 girls who came off the pile along with me. We stood with our chests stuck out. We had on the yellow suits we'd just been issued and the respirator headgear, those fancy magic face masks that you had to wear on most shifts inside. The ceremony only took 10 minutes after all that. For us to be lined up and for Mr. Bell to kiss us each one time on the top of our heads and tighten the straps of our masks with tender ceremony. And then the buzzer sounded for our very first kill floor shift and he said, "All right, y'all, get to it," and we marched inside. By the time that first day ended, my yellow suit was no longer clean. "So," said Castle when he found me in the Johns, "you all right?" "Of course I am." I didn't want Castle to know how I really felt after that first long day inside the cutting house. I'd been very close all day to vomiting, not from the work itself, I guess. That first day all I did was throw the lever of the downpuller machine over and over and over, align the mechanical jaws, press the button, and watch them tug off the cattle hide. One swift motion and the full skin came off, like taking off a shirt. I guess the sight of it over and over. The glistening black and red of the insides, I don't know. But I did. I had felt all day on the brink of vomiting, and I still did even then in the Johns, but I didn't want Castle to know that. I didn't want him to lose his pride in me. "I'm fine," I told him, and I smiled weak and watery.
When I looked at him, I felt like I could see his insides, like his skin had been pulled away. "You'll be all right," he said, like he hadn't heard me say I was fine. He put his hand on my shoulder, which made me jump. He didn't want the old man seeing that, talking close and confidential. The old man or anyone who might tell him. "What's next is what matters," he said. Sure enough, there was Harbor, looking at Castle's hand on me, looking at us whispering all together like that. "What you mean, what's next?" said Harbor with his hard, slit-faced smile. "You mind your own. How about, son?" said Castle. "My own what?" "Everything's everybody's," Harbor smiled. "Right?" That was one of the mottos. Everything's everybody's. Eyes on the prize for you and me and Bell's Farm. Harbor ignored Castle then and talked right to me. Harbor was between my age and Castle's age, but he talked just like a grown man. Talked almost like an old man, actually, like he was in charge of something. "Your man here been talking about what's next. Let me tell you what's next. Today they fit on that mask. Tomorrow you work on the carving line, then the kill floor. Till they put you on the block or put you in the ground. That's what's next." Castle shook me awake that night. Not to tell me any words or stories, his big eyes wider than ever, but serious, focused. "You remember what I told you?" I blinked. He had told me so many things. "They, not us," he said. So quiet I could hardly hear him. "Not Harbor, not anyone. Something'll come for you and me." "What?" I said. "What'll come?" He wasn't even making noise anymore. He just mouthed the word. "Opportunity." Pretty soon I decided that inside was worse than the pile. That was punishable, of course, to think of any kind of work as worse or worst or bad. Thoughts against good work. I kept my thoughts to myself. Out on the pile there was some music in the air, kind of. There was the distant rush and honk of the highway. There was the caw of crows and even on occasion the merry chirrup of a songbird. Inside, the only sounds were work sounds. The chunk-chunk of the bolt gun and the chug-chug of the ramp. The dull, ignorant lowing of the cows, the buzz and rattle of the hot machines, and the nervous click-clack of the boot heels all around you, the old men and the guards strolling with their hands on their holsters, the Franklins with their clipboards, the USDA in their lab coats with their instruments. I got through it by telling myself Castle's stories, all the ones he had told me over all those years. The man who slipped into the water and was eaten by a whale and spat out again. The leopard who cannot change his spots. And the one, my favorite one, about the man who built another man from parts he had found, brought him to life with lightning for magic. Other times I told myself the words, doing my tasks again and again and again, cracking skulls, pulling out viscera, carving out tongues by their thick roots, repeating Castle's old words from under the blanket together, carburetor, Chicago, opportunity. 6 or 8 months after I moved into the cutting floor, Castle shook me awake one night and I was as mad as I'd ever been. "Getting too old for this," I said, grumpy. "No, love," he said. "Don't say that." My hands hurt so much I had been moved from the downpuller onto a straight carving station, and in sleep my hands stayed cramped in the shape that held the knife. "Too old." "I know, dear, I know, but listen, I have to give you something." And always Castle knew what I didn't know yet, because he had seen it happen with the olders. Soon they would come and read his number out and move him to another cabin. He was the oldest of the younger ones, and soon they'd need the room for the new littlest coming out of the breed lot. He'd go to cabin 9, and after a year, on from there to breeding. That night, while he waited for me to wake and listen, his big eyes were full of tears. I think they were. I wish I could remember. "I got a secret to give you. You gotta listen. This matters." "Huh? You listening?" I allowed with a shrug that I was. "We are from the future." "Man, what?" That had woken me all the way. "The future? Castle, come on." But his face was serious, so serious. "We are from the future, my sweet brother. We are future boys, okay?" He was talking too loud. He was all worked up. I put my finger across his lips. He brushed it away. "We look like we're here, with all this, but we're really somewhere else. In the future, we got somewhere else, some other time." "What place you mean?" "I don't know, honey, some place. Chicago, maybe. Future place." He told me stories about that city he got from somewhere. It was a city on the other side of America, buildings upright and proud. "I'm in Chicago, and I'm eating a hot dog." I had to put my cramped hand over my mouth to keep from laughing out loud. Castle had never eaten any hot dogs, and neither had I, but we knew what they were well enough. There was a dancing hot dog on the trucks that rumbled in and out unceasingly from the loading dock on the north side of the kill house. But for our food, we had mostly loaves, dense and filling. Carrot loaves and sorghum loaves and vanilla loaves for a treat. We live in two places at once, you and me. Castle's eyes shone with pleasure, with real, true, electric pleasure. And I felt it arcing between us like starlight. You live here, you live there, you live now, you live later. You live in this place, you live in the other place. There's two of you. Do you understand? I nodded. I wasn't sure that I did, but I wanted him to know that I did. Castle held up two fingers in the dark, and from then on, that was our sign. Two fingers raised and spread apart. It meant you and me, two of us. It meant him and me, but also it meant me and me, and it also meant him and him. Me now, me later. Castle now, Castle later. This place and the other place, here and there, now and later on. Chapter 17. In the morning, in the silence of the waiting room, in the bright light of the small examination room of Dr. Venezia Carbach, I felt the uneasy and unwelcome sensation of being completely alone in the presence of myself. I had spent so much of my life costumed and posing, turning and turning myself like changing the channels on a television set, that sometimes when I was caught, as I was now, in a silent moment just waiting, nothing to do but sit and wait and think in a white and airless room, I felt like a blank screen. I felt like a dead television. I was myself. I was nothing. I sat there in the thin paper robe. My ass was freezing on the steel of the table. The one piece of artwork in Dr. Venezia Carbach's office was a framed print of a Norman Rockwell painting, First Day Jitters. Little black girl in a plain white dress, handing up an apple to her pretty black teacher, and both of them looking shy and aw shucks nervous. That was a famous painting, the first day of class at Little Rock School for Negro Children, 1954. 7 years after Arkansas became free, 9 months after the Supreme Court ruled that freedom wasn't enough. There had to be schools. There had to be a chance. I stared at that schoolteacher now, her wide, excited eyes, her worry, the white bows in her hair. I had read some sort of magazine feature about her recently, the real person, about the way the rest of her life had turned out. I tried to remember where I had read it, tried to remember how she was doing.
Good morning, Mr. Morton. I understand you're here for a checkup. Is that correct?
Yes, Doc, you got it, I said, snapping right into it.
That's right. Let's have a look.
Dr. Venezia Carbach was a white woman in her late 50s or early 60s. Not unfriendly, but not friendly either. Her hair was short and spiked up, boxy and sexless. On her instructions, I removed the robe and sat in my underpants, hands laced in my lap, while she conducted her examination with brisk efficiency. Her fingertips lit on the various regions of my anatomy, torso and limbs, eyes and ears, pulse points and glands. I breathed deeply while she pressed my chest with the cold, flat face of the stethoscope. I opened my mouth and said, ah, and flinched a little while she inspected my throat with the funneled light of the laryngoscope. She started to chart and asked me some questions. Mr. Kenny Morton, it turned out, was the type of old-fashioned, amiable cat who called the doctor Doc, who probably called cops Chief, and who called fat strangers Big Guy. He was the kind of fellow who scratched his head with theatrical uncertainty when asked where his previous physician's practice was located and when his last appointment had taken place. Dr. Venezia Carbach registered no surprise to hear that Mr. Morton had no insurance or current place of employment. I imagined for one sharp second Dr. V's tidy white examination room as the tidy white examination room at the worker care facility in the western section of the GGSI campus. Imagined it splattered with gore, covered with an exuberance of blood. Two dead nurses, jackdaw on the loose. Dr. V wrote everything down on her chart and told me that for a man of my age and height and weight, I seemed to be in fine shape. When she asked what it was that had brought me to the doctor today, I figured that was enough of that. Well, I said, emotion coming hot into my voice, choking me up. Well, and I slid off the examination table and exploded with need. That boy!
What?
Dr. Venezia Carlock stepped backward in startlement while I fought back a sob. I advanced across the small room and grasped her roughly by the shoulders.
That boy y'all got!
There were more graceful ways I could have gone about this. More circumspect methods, more careful.
But I was feeling half off the horse that morning. I was feeling like a battering ram, just wanting to shove and smash through this thing. What had Bridge said in that unwanted casualism? I wanted to get it over with.
What on earth are you talking about?
Said Dr. V, furrowing her brow, playing it confused, putting on a nice show of her own.
What boy?
Come on, I said. Come on now. They brought you a boy. The airlines, a boy. Sunday night, Monday morning. Sir, without turning around, Dr. V extended a leg behind her and kicked the door shut.
The boy! Sir, please!
I waited for some stammering excuse. What are you talking about? I don't understand, but it was too late and she knew it. Her eyes had betrayed her. Her neat physician's mask had slipped to reveal not fear, or not just fear, but also the shock of having been discovered. In a fluid gesture, she turned around, locked the door, and turned back around. She smoothed her white coat with both hands, adjusted the stethoscope that had been jostled, ran thin fingers through her hair.
Okay,
she said.
What about him?
Well,
what the hell, I figured.
Where's he at?
I do not know, and I could not tell you if I did.
She nodded once, a quick bird-like gesture.
Now, as I've said, your checkup shows no areas of concern. Have a good day.
She unlocked the door and opened it, and I was across the room, reaching past her and pushing it closed again. Dr. V's shoulders tensed as she turned to face me, the two of us separated by inches. This was a fine line I was walking here. I'm big, even for a man, and she was small, even for a woman, and the room was small and close.
He's my brother,
I told her quietly, damn near whispering now.
What?
I took two deep breaths. The space between us was ruffled by a drift of warm air from the heating system, riffling Dr. V's short, spiky hair and making it look like white grass.
I don't mean he's my biological brother. I mean he's my brother.
It was a southern voice, PB voice, the blood traces of my old real voice tasting like dirt in my mouth.
You know what that means down there? Raised up together, eyes on each other, family.
I was careful not to say what kind of place it had been. This plantation, or mine, or rig, where Mr. Morton and Jackdaw had been bound together as boys. The full file was empty on Jackdaw's history, and I guessed that Barton and company didn't know any more, and that, regardless, they wouldn't have shared anything with a physician brought in on a freelance basis to tend to him. But this was dangerous territory, and I moved past it quickly.
We come up together 10 years, me and him, but then he gets sold. No warning, no goodbye, that's how it goes, you know?
Dr. V was watching me warily, arms crossed, eyes darting back and forth in the small room. I charged on.
I stay up in Wisconsin. I got people up there. And I've been trying to find him all these years, writing letters to manumits from our old place. Then with the internet, you know everything's easier and harder, too. I'm looking at forums, typing his name in search engines, looking for anyone matching his age, description, you know? Saving up my money and all, like somehow I'm going to put together enough scratch to buy him out.
I looked down. Shook my head self-mockingly, as if a poor freedman like Kenny Morton could ever earn enough to buy a man out of slavery, as if there weren't laws against it.
And then suddenly, jackpot, you know? A decade of nothing, and then one day, up pops the name. Boy called Jackdaw, gone ghost from some Alabama stitch house. Well, first thing I think is, he's here. He was always talking about Indianapolis, don't know how he got it in his head, don't know how he even heard of this place, but that was it. I ever get out of here, you know, just talk, night talk.
Castle and I, talking under the blanket, telling stories, imagining made-up futures, whispering Chicago to each other. And we did, didn't we? We did make it out, did we not? Opportunity came, one, two, three, like horseshoes ringing onto the post, and we flew away. But so I came up here, as someone down Friedmantown, they told me you the doc who sees to run, at least sometimes. Dr. Venezi Carbach's eyes flashed and her arms uncrossed from her chest so she could plant her fists on her hips. She didn't like that the word was out on her. I had rattled the woman for sure. I stared at her pleadingly and she looked back, and behind her the 1954 school teacher waited for her students to arrive, an unlikely hero in Salvation Army shoes surrounded by her uncertain future.
All right, I understand.
The sternness in Dr. V's eyes softened. And her mouth twisted at the corner, she was keeping her voice firm, but with effort now. Something else was trying to find its way out, pity or empathy or kindness.
And what is it that you want?
All I want to do is see him, I said. That's all, just before y'all spirit him away up north, I just got to see him one time. I need him to know I never did forget about him.
And there were tears in my eyes now, of course. Seems like one thing I could always manage was to conjure up some tears into my eyes.
I was still nearly naked just in my underpants, and it only added to the awkward urgency of our exchange that we bore this relation to each other, doctor and patient, woman and man. I just want him to know I never let him out of my heart. I never did. I just want to see him and tell him that. That's all I want. She should have simply said I'm sorry. She should have said there was nothing she could do. I could only imagine the firm instructions she got from Father Barton, the sternness with which his admonitions of silence were delivered. But the ripples were passing over her, the ripples of want. She wanted to help me. She needed to. It was the flip side of the reflexive hatred of Slim and Slim's fat pal. Someone like Dr. V, white and liberal and a child of her era. She wanted and needed for the poor black man in her office, he of humble circumstance and simple hopes, to see that she was not like the sneering bigots and whip-hands of the world, that she was a person of conscience. She was different. Barton would demand that she keep her peace, do as he did in the diner and disclaim all knowledge. But Barton wasn't there. He was an abstraction, and I was there in her office. Mr. Morton was real, hands knitted together, eyes wide with need.
"The problem is," she said slowly, "that I don't actually know his location."
"Look, I don't want to hurt him," I said, "or take him or nothing. I just want to see his face. I want to hold him one more time."
"You're not hearing me. I don't know his location."
But you went to him. I thought, didn't you help him?" She nodded minutely, bird head popping down then up.
"Yes, but I don't know where."
"God damn it, fucking priest, shifty, snake-eyed, base-covering little hypocrite." "What do you mean?"
"Look, okay?"
Her hand ran through her hair.
"I never know much with these situations. I get a call from someone, I don't know who it is. It's a different number every time, okay? That's how this goes. I have a phone they give me, and it rings, and I answer it, and they tell me where to go."
"Where?"
"Downtown."
"Where?"
"The mall. Circle Center Mall."
I nodded. I knew it. Right downtown. You could see its parking garage from the statue of Abe the Martyr.
"But that's not where I met him. That's just where the car picked me up. It was a taxi cab, but not... it wasn't in service. It was just for me."
Barton at work. Cut out operation, prepaid phones, wheels within wheels. "So where'd the car take you? It take you to him?"
"Yes, but blindfolded."
They packed her into the car, drove her for at least an hour, drove her around and around in circles, north and then south, until she could have no idea where she was. And then they guided her out of the car and down a path, rough beneath her feet, slipping some, still blindfolded. When they took off the mask, it was dark, totally dark. Then someone turned on a flashlight, and there he was. "There he was," I repeated softly, remembering the delicate, intelligent face I had seen in the photograph. Dr. V was remembering it, too, standing before me, quiet and thoughtful, reliving the moment when she saw him. She gathered some strength, stepped forward, and laid her small hands on mine.
"You should be happy, Mr. Morton. I have never seen anyone like that young man, never. And now he's going to be free. He's going to be fine."
"No, he's not," I thought. "Because I'm not any damn Mr. Morton, and I'm getting closer. Because I'm a wolf. And I'll find him today. Because Bridge said, if you can't find the man..." I offered Dr. Venezia Carbach a weak, watery smile. "Is he all right, though? What kind of place is this they hold in the man?"
"I don't know, really."
She shook her head softly.
"It was a room. I don't know. There was a generator of some kind, but it kept cutting out, and the lights would flicker on and off.
So like some kind of empty building?" My mind turned, sprinted out in different directions, warehouse district, abandoned homes, unfinished building projects. "What about all your things?" I gestured around the room, stethoscope, laryngoscope, tongue depressor, gauze. "What about all the doctor things?"
"Oh, no,"
she said.
"No, my supplies I brought with me. There wasn't any... no, nothing like that."
In her mind, she was there. The place, lair, hideaway. I could see her seeing it, smelling it. I leaned in.
"What is it?"
I asked, simple and quiet.
"What?"
"There was," she nodded, her small bird eyes narrowed, remembering.
kind of a noise. An odd noise, a whooshing. Like pipes? Like water flowing through pipes.
Pipes, I said. So, a basement? Some sort of cellar, or...
Maybe. It might have been. I don't know. I think that's what I know, okay? I think that's all I can tell you.
The doctor was done. She was casting more and more anxious glances over her shoulder at the door, as if any moment the next patient would come in, or her nurse, or Father Barton himself, glaring with those pale eyes, floating a foot off the floor, leveling a finger at her, denouncing her as a betrayer of the cause.
Well, listen, I said. I thank you so much, I really do. If I can just see his face...
She nodded rapidly, said,
Yes, yes.
And something in the rapidness of her nodding and the way she darted her lips in and out made me wonder if it wasn't just guilt she was feeling, but fear. Who is this Barton anyway? What kind of vengeful Old Testament father are we talking about here? I said thank you a million times. Humbly, I thanked her. Humbly, I assured Dr. Venezia Carbach that her confidence would not be betrayed. She smiled sadly, smoothed her lab coat, and put her face back on.
Oh, actually, though,
I said, when she was almost out the door, when she had almost escaped me. I just have one more quick question, if that's all right.
No, Mr. Morton, I'm sorry. I don't...
Please.
No more questions.
Ma'am, it's just... Why did he need to see a doctor? I did test the leash one time. Very early on, I tested it. Years ago. I suppose I had convinced myself, staring at some hotel room ceiling in an insomniac stupor, as I had lain unsleeping in so many of those early nights, almost every night in the first year of it, that the whole thing was a hoax, a con. They had drugged me, put me in a thick opioid haze for 2 hours, then told me on waking about the tiny computer chip they'd injected in my nervous system, right where the spine touches the brain, that it would be singing out my location from there on out. Ain't no way, I told myself, that shit's impossible, and I'm a fool to believe it. So I refused to believe it. I remember it was the first time that Bridge put me onto a woman. The service name was Darling. I traced poor Darling to goddamn Idaho City, Idaho, and I was supposed to be staking out the home of a relative, a second cousin, I believe. And instead, I shoplifted a change of clothes from a department store and boarded a bus to Oregon, with a vague notion of hitching north to Port Angeles, stowing away on the ferry to Victoria. But when I got off the bus in downtown Portland, what did I see but 3 men in dark suits drinking coffee? All 3 stood up at once, and I turned around and got back on the bus and went back to Idaho and finished that job and the one that came after it. Mr. Bridge never mentioned it, never said, "How was your trip?" That was not his way. The chip was no joke, no hoax. Everything is possible. Everything is real. That woman Darling in Idaho, she wasn't a woman. She was just a girl. She was all of 12 years old. I remember them all. Chapter 18. Curl of smoke was coming up out of my car. I could see it from across 2 lanes of 12th Street, between the spreading leafless arms of an elm tree and the bent trunk of a street lamp. Tendril of smoke rising from somewhere in the hood, rising and spreading and dissipating into the wan daylight like an exorcised spirit. I hustled across the street, thinking for one crazy second that something had happened inside the engine of the sweet little Altima. It had given out and burst into flames and now was sitting there smoldering. But no, of course not. Halfway across the potholed street, I slowed up. Cigarette smoke, that's all. Of course. Someone was leaning against the car on the opposite side, smoking a butt, waiting on me. Had to be Maris. He'd done some digging, or Barton had. They'd pushed through my backstops and figured out that there was no Gentle in Carolina, no Dirksen at all. I looked up and down the street. Was it too late to run? I looked for witnesses and hiding places. I was in the middle of the street. I willed myself some courage, willed myself a gun. Imagined the heavy loose weight of a Colt in the front pocket of my overcoat, jostling against my hip like a deck of cards. It was the girl. The white girl, Martha. She had a chopstick in her hair, holding it together. She looked hesitant, half hopeful. I was so relieved I almost laughed.
It was almost good to see her, and the kid too. Lionel in a tracksuit a size or two too big. Athletic stripes on top and bottom, plugged into his music, grooving his head back and forth like a snake, bouncing on his heels beside the car. He didn't see me coming, but Martha did, and she gave me a funny self-knowing wave and a cringing sort of smile. She was smoking one of those ugly little hand-rolled hipster cigarettes, sourced, free-labor tobacco and all that. "My goodness," I said, "how are you?"
"This is crazy," she said. "I know. I know this is crazy."
"What's crazy?"
"Well, okay, so I need to ask you a favor."
"What can I say? What would Dirksen say?" What did I want to say? I said, "Sure." She pulled out a booster seat from the back seat of her boxy pink SA hatchback, which we left parked on Meridian Street. Away we went. Lionel settled in the back seat and Martha up front beside me, her fingers laced in her lap.
"Where are we headed?"
"This way, I guess," said Martha softly. And I went the way she pointed, straight south down Meridian Street. "So," I said, and she smiled bright but quick.
"So,"
she said, as if this was all perfectly normal, as if we did this every day.
"You had a doctor's appointment."
"Yes," I said, "I did."
"Is everything okay?"
"Oh, yes, thank you, just fine." I was Dirksen. I had my glasses on. I held my hands at 10 and 2 on the wheel. Just a little thing, slipped is all. Out last night working, and I just plumb slipped on the sidewalk and twisted my ankle. Not a big deal. But the folks in Jakarta, you know, any little thing, insurance and all. I was talking too much, polishing my stupid lie until it practically glowed. She'd stopped listening anyway. She gazed out the window. She had on cheap sunglasses, cat's eyes, which went perfectly somehow with the plastic chopsticks in her hair. A vintage day dress, paisleys against midnight blue. Martha also had on this ring, a cheap little shopping mall band of fake gold, and while I drove, she was twisting it on and off, moving it restlessly from finger to finger like she was running a shell game on herself. One thing I was used to seeing from young white people, it was confidence, an easy sense that the world belonged to them. This Martha, she had that too. Even now she was going through my glove compartment, examining my tapes, no big deal. But it was only a thin layer, only on the top. Underneath was all kinds of nervousness and fear.
"Do you mind?"
said Martha, the tape already half pushed into the player. "Not at all." The Jackson 5 sang "Who's Loving You?" MJ out front, his four older brothers doing tight, high harmony in the back. I glanced at Martha. Her head turned to look out the shotgun window, and I saw it again. The black box tatted on her neck, and below it, a glimpse of cream-white skin and pale pink bra. I flushed, confused and obscurely angry. Lionel danced his head like a robot in the back seat. Storefronts rushed past the window. Medical supply, oriental rugs, buildings available for lease. "Okay," I said. "I guess at some point I'll need to know where it is we're going." "Of course," she said.
"Yeah."
Martha took a quick look at Lionel, tuned out, grooving to Michael, a world of his own, and launched in.
"Okay, so what I need," she said, "is like an escort, I guess, like just a friend. I mean, I gotta do this errand, kind of meet this lady. It's just this thing I gotta do. I thought she was gonna come up to the hotel, but now she said I need to come down to her."
Straight-laced Mr. Dirksen frowned a little bit. "Is this in relation to a healthcare position?" And Martha said,
"No, not exactly,"
while my mind clicked through possibilities. Drugs, guns. Easy to imagine Martha, a single mother in thrift shop clothes, lugging around some wagon of debt she was trying to get shed of. Martha still wasn't telling me where we were going. We were just going. I turned right on 16th Street. I stopped for a red at North Capitol.
"And I've been advised, God, Jesus, that sounds so fancy."
Martha made a fancy voice, uptown lawyer, mock snooty.
"I have been advised not to go by myself, you know, as a..."
She looked over at me. The light turned green.
"As a girl."
She didn't say as a white girl. But there it was, with us in the car anyway. I nodded.
"But, so, you just... you're a helper. You're obviously one of the good guys, so I thought..."
I said nothing. In my silence, I knew she would attribute to shyness or modesty when, in fact, I was muzzled by the horror of it. The dark, grieving irony of the idea that I would be a good person. That I would obviously be such a person.
I blinked back to life and turned left on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Street. I had an idea already of where we were going. I could feel it coming. Michael came into the last chorus, soared right up into it like a little angel.
I'm not going to even offer